Was he mad at a kid for being backstage at this VIP party? Did he want me kicked out? I had no idea, but was about to find out as he began to make a beeline for me. "Hey, kid," he said gruffly. "Yes, Mr. Belushi. What you doing here?" "We were in the audience tonight." "Oh," he said. He was jittery, vibrating with a weird energy. "So, what do you want to be when you grow up?" he asked, softening with a smile. "I want to be an actor, like you." He looked at me for a long, drawn-out moment, and at once I knew I had said something wrong. His entire face fell. His mood darkened in an instant. Then he pulled me close and whispered in my ear in a voice so thick I almost couldn't understand him. "Stay out of the clubs." I should have listened. Instead, I got my first agent. Chapter 5. I'm standing on the roof of a rundown barn in our backyard corral. Below me, Chris Penn and my brother Chad are setting up an 8mm camera. Chris is directing me in our mutually produced version of The $6 Million Man. Chris has learned from his father Leo, a noted television director, the intricacies of special effects, and has concocted a plan for me, as Colonel Steve Austin, to leap two stories to the top of the barn roof. Unfortunately for me, it will require me to jump off the roof backward. The film will then be reversed, making it appear as if I have leaped up instead of down. Chad takes pity on me and drags an old, moldy beanbag chair we found in the garage and places it underneath me to break my fall. High up on my perch, I can see all the way to the ocean. There's a nice breeze at my back. I look down at the beanbag and think, I bet you Leo Penn ain't asking his stuntman to jump into any beanbag chairs. Any normal person would tell Chris Penn to come up here and do it himself. Alas, I am deeply competitive and an adrenaline junkie and never back down from a challenge. I'm also happy he's finally included me in one of his Penn-Sheen movie epics they've been filming all around our neighborhood. If I were to defer, I'm sure Sean or Charlie or Emilio would have gotten the nod for this plum role. And action, Chris yells, looking through the camera. I glance at my brother, who turns away. Fuck it, how bad could it be, I think, and I spring out, off my toes, facing away, but aiming for the beanbag, trying to clear the roof's overhang. I hit the beanbag dead center. I feel a snap in my ankle, followed by white-hot pain. Immediately, I know it's broken. On some level, you have to be crazy to be an actor. You must have a masochistic streak to deal with the rejection and failure and the unrelenting scrutiny and success. You must be able to shut off your logical brain, the voice that reminds you, 2/3 of the Screen Actors Guild makes less than $1,000 a year. Get a real job. Or, don't jump off this roof, you moron. But if acting truly is your calling, if it's really in your blood, you will have these tragic, heroic flaws in spades. And when you are filming a scene or a stunt, even for an 8th grade home movie and break an ankle, you won't ask for a doctor. You will ask, did you get the shot? And if the answer is yes, there will be no more pain, only euphoria. I had just acquired an agent. Looking for advice, I cold called a girl in my neighborhood who had played Cloris Leachman's daughter on a TV show. She told me that no one goes anywhere in Hollywood without an agent. Fortunately, my dad had an ex-client who had relocated to L.A. and was a junior agent at a small agency. I went to their office, located in a tiny building on Melrose Place. Yes, there is a real Melrose Place. And met the woman who would become my first agent. Soon, I was hopping on the bus after school, headed to Hollywood for my first professional auditions. Sometimes I would be on various buses for 3 hours one way, and in the auditions for 30 seconds, literally. Since I was so inexperienced, the parts were really nothing more than background or extra opportunities or commercials. They would call your name, take a Polaroid, and send you on your way. But I didn't care. I did my homework on the ride home, wolfed down a meal, and went straight to bed, as it was always late by the time I made my way back to Point Doom. In spite of being on crutches after my big stunt jump, I still managed to catch my buses into Hollywood for the occasional audition. So far, there were no takers. Maybe it was due to my amateurish 8x10, which in those days was called a composite, because it had a number of different photos on it meant to represent different sides of your personality. Mine had photos of me skateboarding, dressed up as a magician, and as a soccer player. Unfortunately, the photographer who shot me didn't have any wardrobe or props, and I didn't know to provide my own. So as the magician, instead of a top hat, I was shot pulling a rabbit out of the stupid-looking bucket hat like Gilligan wore and holding onto a basketball dressed in my soccer outfit. Even then, I knew my composite was a disaster. But my agent told me, no one cares about those kind of things. It may very well have been the first time I was encouraged to discount my instincts in favor of expedience, but it would not be the last. I wish I had known what I know now. Trust your gut always. After all, it won't be anybody but you looking like an idiot holding a basketball while dressed like Pele. At school, we all began to buzz about Halloween, which was fast approaching and was a big deal on Point Doom. It was a perfect excuse for the already wild and lawless band of kids to run amok, dousing tires with gasoline and rolling them down into streets into crowds of unsuspecting children, filling gas tanks with sugar and egging people in the face at point-blank range. Shaving cream was used as mace. It was Christmas morning for bullies. And, truth be told, I was not immune to the low-grade thrill of anarchy myself. I also would be appropriately armed for my own defense if needed. Stocked with a dozen eggs and a canister full of Barbasol, I met up with my group of friends to make our rounds. It was a perfect, dry, breezy, moonless night. None of us wore costumes. That was for kids, not young men on a mission. If we felt like trick-or-treating, we might pull out a 20-cent mask if needed. My first stop was the Sheen's house. Knocking on the door, I hoped I might get a glimpse of the then-legendary Martin Sheen, who had recently returned from his 2-year odyssey of making Apocalypse Now. There were rumors that the movie had almost killed him, and that he might have gone insane while shooting it in the fetid jungle of the Philippines. Although I'd spent some time with Charlie and Emilio making our amateur movies, they never really discussed their father. I was even more curious about him when I learned that he, too, had begun his acting career from his hometown of Dayton, Ohio. My friends and I waited at the door, but no one answered. So we moved on to other homes and an egg-throwing scrimmage or two. As we plotted our next move, a figure jumped out of a bush, scaring us to death. "What are you boys doing?" demanded a man dressed from head to toe in army fatigues and wielding a gigantic baseball bat. "Nothing. We're just trick-or-treating," we answered. The man leaned in to have a closer look. In the blackness, it appeared that he might have war paint on his face, but it was hard to tell. "This is my neighborhood. I am on patrol tonight. There will be no monkey business on my watch. Do you understand?" He looked at my friends, who said nothing. "Do you understand?" he said again, this time looking at me. "Yes, sir," I answered, knowing that it was probably a good idea to use the word sir when confronted in the dark by a bat-swinging army-uniformed dude with security on his mind. "Good," he said, then smashed the bat on the pavement, making us jump. "I'll be watching." And with that, he turned and disappeared into the darkness. When the coast was clear, one of my friends exhaled and chuckled. "Hey, Lo, you said you wanted to meet Martin Sheen. Well, now you have." One morning, I sat on the school bus with my crowd of kids in the economy class area and talked and studied as usual. But back in the VIP area, something was up. Over the din of the radio playing "If You Leave Me Now" by Chicago, you could hear crying and frantic whispering. I craned my head to see what the commotion was, but the bus was packed and I couldn't see. As we emptied out into the parking lot, I saw the blonde surfer girl who had had the birthday party with the amber bottle. She was the one who had been crying. The rest of the surf gang was skittish and ashen-faced. What the hell was up? By second period, everyone knew. As usual, there was no adult or authority figure stepping up to give guidance or information, so the news spread kid to kid. Peter, the golden surf god, was missing. There were dark rumors that he might have been in some terrible accident. By lunchtime, sheriffs were taking members of Peter's gang to the principal's office for questioning. By the final bell that day, it was clear. Peter had disappeared, and no one knew where or why. Bad things happen to kids every day. It is the core-shaking truth. We don't like to face it. We will do anything to avoid it. And we attempt to find comfort in the knowledge that it is, mercifully, fairly infrequent. But in the beautiful idyll of Point Doom, above the forgotten Chumash burial grounds, there was a savage undercurrent running through the lives of the boys and girls of those endless summers. Some of the blame falls to the parents, the checked-out, live-and-let-live generation who came of age at Woodstock. Some of it falls to the kids themselves, unformed, undisciplined, unsupervised, and wrestling with all the promise and angst of their tender possibilities. But some of it, and maybe a lot of it, came from the environment. And Malibu, with its beautiful facade covering its complex, dangerous underbelly, was an environment with the energy field of seven supernovas. Peter was the first one to be sucked into the vortex. They had all ditched school the day before. Surf was up, sun was out, and the party was on. At Zuma Beach, they laid out their towels. I probably could have seen them out the bus window if I'd been looking. Peter, his girlfriend, and the others of his group spread their towels on the sand and stripped off their clothes. Some of them swam. Some of them baked in the Southern California sun. There was pot. One of the kids pulled out a bottle of Quaaludes. Soon, darkness was upon them. Under questioning late the next day, the order of events became clear. They had all fallen asleep or passed out on the beach, all except Peter, who, high on Quaaludes, went for a swim. When they awoke, he was gone. They searched for hours. The kids would have to be home soon, and they began to panic. Peter's clothes were lying on his towel where he'd left them. In an effort to avoid getting into trouble, they dug a hole. They collected his clothes and towel and buried them. Their plan was to deny any involvement in whatever may have happened to Peter. And the plan held together for 24 hours until someone cracked. Peter was never found. Later, they created a small park in his honor in front of the Malibu Cinema. His friends marked their loss by creating a touching and profoundly creepy ritual. The cool crowd held Peter's seat empty on the bus each day, preventing anyone from sitting in his spot by the back window. He was 14 years old. Although my mom's health seemed to be much better, she and Steve dug into her obsession with alternative medicines and holistic treatments. She devoured medical books, self-help books, and began to delve deeply into analysis, reading everything from the otherworldly, Seth Speaks, to the scholarly, the entire canon of Carl Jung. Our dinner table talks were peppered with phrases like the collective unconscious, and Steve and my mom deconstructed their nightly dreams like another couple might rehash a good movie. Mom redoubled her journal writing, her dream diary, and began writing short stories, novels, you name it. She was now spending at least 4 hours a day, every day, behind closed doors writing. If there was ever a finished project to read, we didn't know about it and were not allowed to read it. Once, when I asked my mom why she worked so hard at writing, but from my perspective, had nothing to show for it, she said, "I don't write for a result. I write for the process and what it teaches me about myself." Meanwhile, I wasn't acting at all, unless you count our homespun $6 million man. There was no setup for a local theater in Southern California. Back in Ohio, I could do summer stock and plays at the community theaters and university theaters. But in LA, it was different. And to this day, the theater scene here is an afterthought. Until I cracked into real show business, I would have to be content to sit on the sidelines and be satisfied with chance encounters with people who were already in the game. The sort of thing that can only happen in and around Hollywood. Steve's brother and sister-in-law visited us from time to time and told us stories of their adventures as starving artists in the bohemian world of avant-garde filmmaking and rudimentary animation. Both graduates of the prestigious CalArts, they were among a small group of animators pioneering a new process known as rotoscope, which in 1977 was the CGI of its day. For months, they bitched about their latest job, a cheap, low-budget movie that they described as a cheesy Western set in outer space. Regardless of their complaining, a movie's a movie, and I wanted to check it out. On the big day, the family piles into our Volvo station wagon. Whoever sold the American public on Volvo being the standard of safety and reliability never drove our car. It sucked. We drive to a seedy, run-down industrial area of the San Fernando Valley, populated by Mexican chop shops, porn distribution warehouses, and abandoned garages. Finally, we're led into a large cinder block building through an industrial metal sliding garage door by a guy who looks like Jerry Garcia. Inside, my aunt and uncle are waiting. "This is where you're shooting the movie?" I ask. "The place looks more like a hideout for the Symbionese Liberation Army." Jerry Garcia explains that the shooting for the movie is finished and this is where the special effects will be added. "Why does it smell bad?" Chad asks. Jerry and my aunt and uncle laugh. "It does reek, doesn't it? It's the costumes. They're pretty dirty and gross at this point." We enter the main area of the warehouse, Suddenly, people are everywhere. The room is filled with energy. Tonight, we are shooting footage for the climatic battle scene, someone explains. In front of me is a giant platform about chest high and easily 40 yards long and 20 yards wide. It's covered with monochromatic, battleship gray, miniature towers, buildings, trenches, gun portals, and radar dishes. I can see that it is constructed with spray-painted egg cartons, elements of old battleship and tank parts, and other pieces of toys and everyday items. But in the hands of these crazy hippies, it looks like the surface of an absolutely enormous alien planet. What is this supposed to be? I ask, amazed. My uncle looks at the gigantic layout and smiles. This is the Death Star. Action! Yells the cameraman. A specifically built, the first of its kind in the world, I'm told, camera is lowered into the main trench of the Death Star. It moves at a snail's pace down the crevice running the length of the platform. Later, we'll speed the film up and add a spaceship flying over this shot we're making right now, says my uncle. I want to see the spaceship, I say. It's right over there, he says, pointing to another corner of the warehouse. And there, sitting in front of what I will learn is a blue screen, is a 6-foot-long model of the coolest spaceship I've ever seen. It's called the Millennium Falcon. I run my hand over it. Chad stares too, slack-jawed. Well, why don't you come and look at some rough footage on the big screen? Garcia says. We file into a filthy makeshift screening room. I'm introduced to my aunt and uncle's boss. Hi, I'm John Dykstra. I'm the visual effects coordinator. I'm just about to watch some scenes we're working on. As the lights go down, I turn to him and ask, what's this movie called? Star Wars, he says. Even though most of the effects have not been added, what I see on screen makes the hair on the back of my neck stand up. When the hero grabs the girl and swings out on a safety rope, even though they're flying about a foot off the studio floor, I don't need the bottomless Death Star shaft to feel the rush. When the villain appears in a black mask and helmet, I am riveted, even when he pulls out a cool handle with a broomstick on it and begins a sword fight. Now this is what I do, says my aunt. I'm going to add a laser over the broom handle. It's going to be a laser sword. No. We're going to call it a lightsaber, says Dykstra. When the clips are over, we stop to see a small robot that is shaped like a trash can. Apparently, the robot is a major character in this movie, and I think the name is cool, R2-D2. My brother and I also check out Luke Skywalker's hovercraft, which has mirrors covering the wheels underneath it to give it a rudimentary effect of hovering. Later, even that will be rotoscoped out for better effect to make it look like it's flying. On our way out, we pass the source of the terrible odor that has been wafting through the building. It is a giant woolly mammoth-looking costume for a character to be called a Bantha. It seems like they are the horses of the future, but they stink like dead elephants. And indeed, that's what's been wearing this gross and stinky costume. Yeah, the guy who rode it got thrown off, almost broke his neck, says Jerry Garcia. The next day at school, I tell all my friends about this amazing new movie that isn't coming out for months, but is going to be the coolest thing ever. In my opinion, and I'm hardly alone, Star Wars did change the world. The movie business was never the same. The era of the blockbuster and the tentpole was now on the horizon. And, following the money, as always, was corporate America and the dubious model of vertical integration. Star Wars made it attractive for an engine turbine company like GE to want anything to do with an inherently flaky, artistic business that couldn't be decoded by bean counters, MBAs, or bottom-line hawks as much as they continued to try. Luke Skywalker's photon torpedo not only blew up the Death Star from its warehouse in North Hollywood, it ended an era where the movie business was run by people who, first and foremost, loved movies. Through all the years and all the changes it brought, I still feel lucky to have witnessed the birth of the movie that changed it all. We are going broke. My mom and Steve are increasingly at odds. He works for the county government as a shrink. He doesn't have a private practice like the big guns in Beverly Hills, and I have no idea why. And my dad is always late with the child support. I'm sure my dad's point of view is, let the new dad hustle up some money. The tension in the house is overt. There's no attempt to keep those issues from me and my brothers, and as a result, I am anxious and melancholy. When I hear that my dad is ducking his financial commitment to us, I take it personally. Is there something I should do about this? Is this in some way representative of how dad feels about us? It also occurs to me that perhaps I'm only hearing my mom and Steve's side of the story. I want to call my father, but I'm scared. Long distance equals expensive, and would have no idea how to begin a conversation about anything real, any interaction about our relationship. As always, I want to keep my head down and assume all is well. If there is an 800-pound gorilla in the room, I don't want to be the one to point it out, lest I be eaten by it. Although my classmates at school are decidedly middle class, the few who do have money are the popular ones, so there's plenty of the kind of talk that comes from cool kids with cash. Exotic vacations, new skis, fun restaurants, new clothes, and what kind of party to have when the parents are out of town. We can't afford restaurants much. But if we do go out, the rule is this: no desserts. And there's never a vacation. And no new clothes. When I attend a bar mitzvah, I realize I don't own a belt, and my mom gives me a camera strap to use. I'm ashamed that I don't have the proper clothes for this special occasion. I want to be respectful, and that's a hard look to pull off with a camera strap around your waist. But this is where my ability to ignore reality is a gift. I walk in like I'm dressed like James Bond. No one says a word, and in fact, one girl asks me where I got the cool belt. Fake confidence on the outside, I will later learn, often trumps truthful turmoil on the inside. Armed with this confidence, I begin to put my toe into school politics. I'm savvy enough to know that I can't compete with the handsome, older, and more athletic Emilio Estevez for boys' vice president, so I choose an office no one else wants, parliamentarian. When I tell you that I wasn't a cool kid at Malibu Junior High, consider this entry from that year's yearbook. Evan is a babe, but you are a gay. Sorry, better luck next time. As for the election, at the last second, a kid even more nerdy than I am runs against me. I crush him. As the first order of business, the new student council stages a skateboard contest fundraiser. The winner is a great-looking kid, a year older, named Paul, who runs with a rough crowd from down in Santa Monica, or Dogtown, as they call it. They are the pioneers of the mid-70s skateboarding boom. Paul is the first person I ever knew to have his own poster. Looking at him, doing one of the sport's first aerials, I think, I want to be on a poster. A girl who I've been doing scenes with in my drama class, Holly Robinson, is popular. She's a bit of an icon, being one of the only two black girls in the school and having a father back east who appeared on Sesame Street. Holly is the star of all the talent shows, and even people like Linda Ronstadt make the pilgrimage to our school auditorium to hear her sing. Later in life, Holly will have a great career of her own, starring in tons of television shows. But now, we do our scenes together in front of the drama teacher, who, the rumor goes, once stored a dead body in an industrial freezer. Which seems outrageous to me, as there is nothing to indicate that the poor man even owns an industrial freezer. Holly has the hots for Paul and is talking to him after the skateboard contest award ceremony. She's standing with her mother, Dolores, who is a fledgling Hollywood manager, and with some guy I've never seen before. Holly and I are good enough friends now, so I walk over and say hi. Dolores knows I want to be an actor, and she puts her arm around me. How's it going? Okay, I say, trying to be optimistic in front of somebody who's legit. Well, you keep pushing. You'll get there, she says. I look at Holly, but she's looking at Paul. Oh, and I want you to meet my client, she says, gesturing to the guy standing next to her. I want you to take a good long look at this amazing young man. Take a moment in and remember it, because I promise you that this time next week, he is going to be the most famous person in America. I look him over. He's not all that much older than me, really, maybe 19 or 20. He's black, with big, sweet eyes. I'm not sure what the hell Dolores is talking about, but she is deadly serious, so I'm paying attention. Hi, I'm Rob. He smiles dazzlingly. Hi, I'm LeVar. By the following Friday, LeVar Burton was the most famous face in America. His performance as Kunta Kinte in Roots put him on the cover of Time magazine and changed the course of television history. It also showed me how quickly the rocket fuel of stardom can ignite, how unimaginably giant the G-forces can be as you are propelled into fame's orbit. Looking back, I also have to wonder at the mystery of destiny and fate. I marvel at the mercurial forces of fortune and am reminded that one must be ever vigilant to stay on one's own path without envy of others. As the four of us stood in that afternoon light that day, LeVar was a week away from his triumphant destiny. Dolores was just beginning her journey, one that would make her one of the business's first important black female managers, with clients like Wesley Snipes and Martin and Charlie Sheen. And Holly would be just 6 months away from starring in her first major TV role. Paul was in every skateboard magazine in the country, had girls falling all over themselves, and his poster on the walls of teen girls and guys. I was still being called an acting fag at school and struggling to break in Hollywood. But fortunes change. Within a month, I got that first break, so long in coming. And within a few years, Paul had become the most notorious of all of Malibu's lost boys when, high on PCP, he stabbed his mother to death with a butcher knife and was put away in an insane asylum. Chapter 6. "I hope you like my birthday present," she says, handing me a package. She's practically shaking with excitement. Her green eyes are gleaming. "I'm sure it's great," I say, although I can't imagine what could be worth getting in a box as small as the one she's just handed me. We are on what I am gradually realizing is a de facto date. She's cooked me dinner, just the two of us, alone in a mobile home overlooking the beach near Paradise Cove. It's taken me a while to figure this out for two reasons. One, I'm not exactly Mr. Popularity with the ladies, and two, she's my little brother Micah's 16-year-old babysitter. I've known her for a while. She's given me rides to school in her red Ford pickup, and being a driver and all, to me, she might as well be an adult. Like me, she's sort of a social outsider. Her obsession is horses, and she goes to a strange granola-crunching high school that no one's really heard of. But she's always nice to me, has beautiful eyes, fair faucet hair, and, Lord help me, an amazing body. Recently, she has been relentless about wanting to cook me dinner for my 14th birthday. I say yes without much thought to it one way or the other. She's a cool pal, and I'll suffer a bad meal if she's going to make such an issue of it. Also, we are going to celebrate my first two professional jobs in Hollywood. One is a commercial for Coca-Cola, the most expensive one they've ever done, and for the first time ever, made exclusively to be broadcast on the Super Bowl. The other is for some sort of blender that co-stars a former Miss America. And I'm basically an extra in both commercials, but you'd have thought I was starring in a major motion picture. A pro gig is a pro gig, and I'm thrilled to have finally broken in. I'm paid $2,500 for the Coke commercial. I frame the check. "Come on, open it," she says, and so I do. I tear open the wrapping paper, Christmas patterns, and look at the tiny present. She grins, and my heart pounds. It's a condom. A Trojan, just like the one in my dad's sock drawer back in Ohio. Now I get it. The dinner alone, at night, the secluded location. It's all a setup. Her master plan. For my 14th birthday, I am going to lose my virginity. I feel the slow, hot burn of what we today call performance anxiety flush through my body. I could, I suppose, not live up to my end of this elaborate plan, but that would be the wimp move, and I would never back down like that. It just feels a tad rushed and contrived, and certainly not of my own making. It's clear that short of using the chicken exit like those on a roller coaster, I'm going to have to ride this baby all the way, like it or not. And what's not to like, really? Older girl, very cute, handpicks her prey and does all the work. I guess I could have chosen my own time and place, but at the rate I was going, it could have been years until I got it together. I had no game at all. Any attention I ever got from the opposite sex as a teen was purely a result of the girl knowing the score and acting on it. I had no killer instinct. That would come later. Turns out, it's her first time too. So, together on a moonlit beach, we cross that wondrous, anxiety-filled Rubicon, cutting away the last vestige of childhood. I wasn't in love. She wasn't even my girlfriend. But she was kind, she was pretty, and she was my good friend. I was too young to know how valuable and rare that combination is. But after that warm March night in Paradise Cove, I was on the road to finding out. Other than summer vacations, I saw my father only for ski trips. We met in Snowbird, Utah, and his method of throwing Chad and me at the top of the expert runs and letting us figure it out made us very good. I looked forward to being with my dad. He was unlike any man in my life. Whereas my two stepfathers were cerebral and sometimes socially awkward, my dad had the UVA law degree and the charisma of an actor. Women loved him, and he loved them. With other guys, he was funny, competitive, and a loyal friend. He also had no qualms about busting somebody up at the slightest provocation. He knew that even though it may be politically incorrect in a touchy-feely world, sometimes you had to kick a little ass. When I was living with my mom and Bill back in Dayton, I had a pet bunny named Miss Bun. One of the North Dayton hoods was jealous of my white rabbit, and I returned one day from school to see its disemboweled body lying in a grotesque scarlet pool in our snow-covered yard. Miss Bun had been sliced in half with a knife. My mother and Bill held no one responsible, treating it as a piece of bad luck, something that just happened. Had I been living with my dad, he would have tracked down the perpetrator, and there would have been a second disembowelment. Skiing helped me come into my own. I was also playing Pony League baseball and finally outgrew my last-to-be-picked athletic stage. The birthday at Paradise Cove, my two commercials, and my widening circle of friends at school were all ingredients in my slowly simmering stew of confidence. I decided to enter the school's annual turkey trot, a big deal at Malibu Park. How fast can a race be with the words turkey and trot in its name, I figured. Turns out the answer is very, very fast. I was smoked by a kid from a lower grade. The guy was a rocket. I mean, he ran like he was Superman. And turns out he would actually become Superman, playing the Man of Steel on Lois and Clark alongside Terry Hatcher from 1993 to 1997. Dean Cain wasn't an actor then. He wasn't even thinking about being one. In fact, he, like Charlie Sheen, wanted to be a pro ball player. Dean was eventually recruited by the Dallas Cowboys, and Charlie was a promising baseball player. In spite of the odd 8mm home movie making, I was the only guy going pro as an actor. And for every kid on a date with destiny, there continued to be those on course for tragedy. The ranks of the Lost Boys of Malibu grew at a steady rate. Shane, the sweet, goofy kid from my woodshop class, went home one day, snorted rat poison, thinking it was cocaine, and died instantly. Sam, a young kid from Point Doom, lost control of his 10-speed on the way home from school and impaled his head on a tree. He bled to death, hanging from the trunk of a eucalyptus tree on Bonzel Drive. An older kid at the school dropped out suddenly and moved away entirely. We later learned his dark story. Hitchhiking on the Pacific Coast Highway, he had been picked up by a man, driven to a remote canyon, tied to a tree naked, and had his pubic hair plucked out one by one with a tweezer. There was also my brother Micah's friend, the animal lover. Scuba diving at night with his girlfriend, he decided to rescue lobsters from a lobster trap. He got his hand caught in the mechanism and eventually ran out of air 60 feet below the surface, while his girlfriend struggled unsuccessfully to release him. And there was my buddy Tony, who heard a gunshot from a garage in Malibu West and rushed inside to investigate. He found a high school kid, his intestines hanging out, from the self-inflicted shotgun blast. The kid muttered, "I'm going to be sick, I'm going to be sick," over and over as he lay dying next to his parents' station wagon. Within a few years, my friend Tony would be dead too, from a weird new cancer. It would be years later before they figured out what to call it. Sadly, AIDS was around way before the death of Rock Hudson. Underneath the glorious exuberance and the counterculture ethos, the fantastical weather and dreamlike beauty, Malibu's malignant undercurrents were a hidden danger to adults as well. An elaborate escape lane had to be devised at the intersection of Canaan Road and Pacific Coast Highway after a number of trucks lost their brakes and careened down the hill, killing their drivers. The Point Doom school bus was traumatized by the sight of more than one driver's burning body crushed in the cab of their truck. At Little Doom Beach, we mourned the death of the couple who kayaked every weekend from Paradise Cove to the buoy anchored off the point. They'd been doing this for years until the foggy morning when they were both attacked and eaten by a great white shark. All that was found was their beloved kayak with bite marks and the signs of an awful struggle. Why was hideous and untimely death so commingled in the experience that was Malibu in the mid-70s? There were drugs, which weren't as understood as they are today. There were also the wild and rough nature of the personalities Malibu attracted. But more importantly, there was a price to be paid for a culture that idealizes the relentless pursuit of self. Malibu was the wellspring of counterculture groupthink. To be counter to the culture, you are by definition willfully and actively ignoring the culture, i.e. reality. And when you ignore reality for too long, you begin to feel immune to or above the gravitational pull that bounds everyone else. You're courting disaster. Money was still tight at home. Mom and Steve were at war with my dad. If he can't make his child support payments, how does he manage the ski trips? Mom wondered. At one point, Steve called my dad to complain. How about I fly out there, knock on your door, and kick your ass? My dad responded. Shaken, Steve hung up and asked my mom if he meant it. Probably, Mom said. I figured I could at least make my own spending money by getting some sort of part-time job. True to my passion, I found one at the Malibu Cinema, taking tickets, making popcorn, and threading the projector. The owner seemed gruff and fairly mean-spirited, but how bad could he have been to give a kid like me a legit job at my age? I lasted about 14 days. First, I was caught kissing Holly Robinson behind the Coke machine. Then came the Friday night opening of Dustin Hoffman's new opus, Agatha. This was a time in Hollywood when an A-lister would still do a movie whose title didn't refer to his own character. I had been struggling to learn how to properly thread the new projector. It was a complicated system where each reel was put on its own platter and then run through the projector at the proper moment. Obviously, placing the films in the correct order was paramount. But somehow, I bungled it. The audience erupted in confusion and rage as one moment Dustin Hoffman was in a rainstorm, hanging dangerously off of a rooftop, then, in the next angle, wore a tuxedo and danced the foxtrot. To make matters worse, in the next moment, the end credits began, and when they were over, there was Dustin doing some sort of love scene. The full house asked for its money back. I was fired on the spot. I didn't have much luck as a busboy, either. I lasted 3 weeks at the Nantucket Light before I was a casualty of downsizing. It probably didn't help that I was known for sneaking free slices of mud pie in the walk-in freezer. All along, I continued my journeys into Hollywood for auditions. The best my agency could do for me were meetings on commercials. TV and movie meetings were clearly way beyond both of our credentials. I had recently gotten a commercial for Carl's Jr., a West Coast hamburger chain. I was pumped because I loved hamburgers, and the concept of being paid to eat as many hamburgers as I wanted sounded pretty good to my teenage mind. I also got a speaking part this time, biting into a burger and yelling, "I've got taste!" over and over. By the fourth hour, I was ready to vomit. My co-star, a local LA newscaster named Regis Philbin, was clearly a pro. After every bite, he'd yell, "I've got taste," and then spit his mouthful of hamburger into a bucket he had strategically hidden underneath his chair. I had a lot to learn. The commercial ran relentlessly that spring and did wonders for my social standing at school. Even some of the cool surfers would call out, "I've got taste," when they passed me in the halls. It wasn't quite enough juice for them to let me paddle out and try my hand at surfing. They'd still beat the shit out of me if I tried. Or to earn a seat in the back of the bus, but it was a start, and I'd take it. Everyone knows that being a teenager is a time of profound emotion. The moody, exuberant, passionate, lethargic teen is a figure that has a special place in the Hall of Fame of cliches. And for good reason. It's all true. When we ourselves are teenagers, we are living life as it comes. There is no point in reflection. We are so inexperienced that there is very little to reflect on. If we fail a big test, we just move on. We win an award and we smile and say thank you. We fall in love and it's a thrill. We get our hearts broken and we suffer. And we feel all of these highs and lows in our absolute core. It feels as if it's never happened to anyone else because it's never happened to us before. Only later can we look back in the comfort that perspective brings. I'm writing this looking out the window at my youngest son playing with his dog, David. He is exactly the same age I was at this point in the narrative. Every parent feels that wondrous, prideful pang when they see glimpses of themselves in their children. I'm no different. I'm looking at him now, rolling on the grass, backlit by the afternoon sun. He is a boy man, wanting everything the world has to offer and ready for none of it. Wanting a girl, but with no idea of how to get one. Wanting to make his mark in the world, but unsure of how to do it. I look at my boy, and I am looking at myself. I want to run out into the yard and tell my young self that it's okay, that all will be revealed in time. I want to give the advice I know he needs to hear. And on the occasions when I do talk to my boys about love, career, family, and all of life's unknowable mystery, I realize that I am also talking to myself. And I wonder, would my life have turned out any differently if I'd have had this perspective? My first love was Corey, a china blue-eyed blonde with a rosebud mouth. She, for some reason, had gone totally undiscovered by the ruling class in spite of her archetypal beach bunny credentials. But that was good news for me, as there was no competition for this overlooked beauty. I was stunned when she indicated she was interested in me. I was about to graduate from Malibu Park Junior High, and she was a year behind me. Looking back, that probably gave me a leg up. It was intense and full throttle from the get-go, the kind of euphoric mutual connection that I hope my boys will not have to suffer. Every spare moment was spent together, and we drove our parents crazy shuttling us the 15 miles or so between each other's houses. I was a 15-year-old walking hormone, and after years of disinterest from most of the female set, I couldn't quite believe that a girl like her could like a guy like me, someone who never really fit in. But she did, and it changed my life forever. The pilot comes on to tell us that we are at our cruising altitude of 35,000 feet. I look around the plane, and I want to throw myself out an exit and plummet to the ground. I'm on my way to my annual sojourn in Ohio, and I'm miserable. I want to be back in Malibu with my new girlfriend. It is torture to go a full day without seeing her, and now I'm going to be gone for 5 weeks? I'm sentenced to a summer of tennis in 90% humidity and walks to the Dairy Queen with my brother, while she will be lying out topless on the beach or sunbathing on her roof covered in Crisco while the local sheriff's helicopter circles her house. That scenario would make even Hugh Hefner insecure. After a week in Dayton, I'm dying. Even my ability to consume as many beers as I want doesn't dent my depression and my longing. Corey and I talk on the phone, but she's rarely home. It's summer in Malibu, after all. I'm stuck inside, avoiding the Midwestern humidifying oven outside, staring at the phone, waiting for the moment we can connect. Finally, the phone rings. It's my agent. He tells me there's an open audition, i.e. cattle call, for a new TV series I might be right for. If I can fly myself back to LA next week, he can get me to read for the producers. I jump at the chance. One way or another, I'm coming back, I say. My dad and mom have a moment of detente and take pity on me. They okay my return. As I pack to fly back to LA, I'm giddy with excitement. This is what I've been dreaming of, what I've been wishing for with such passion. I'm going home to see my girlfriend. And oh yeah, I'm also going to be auditioning for a new TV series. It's called A New Kind of Family. It's for ABC, and the story focuses on two divorcees and their young kids sharing the same house. Years later, this exact premise will be redone to great success in Kate and Allie. I've never had a proper audition. For commercials, they basically just ogle you and send you home. Now, I will have to attempt the horrific gauntlet that is the Hollywood audition. Apparently, there is not yet a script. So for my reading, I'm given a scene from Happy Days. I will be reading the part of Richie Cunningham in a scene where he has a malt with Fonzie. Obviously, this has nothing to do with the premise of the new show or the characters I will be playing, but what the hell? They're the experts, right? Back in Malibu, if I'm not at the beach with Corey, I'm studying my lines. I have no coach, no feedback from anyone whatsoever. I don't run lines with anyone, and I prepare just like I have since the days of peanut butter and jelly. I am also still so green that I am blessed by ignorance of the odds against me. There are probably hundreds of actors auditioning for this part, and very likely there is a list of 10 actors that the producers are likely to cast. I'm too inexperienced to know that getting this part is akin to walking into 7-Eleven, buying a lottery ticket, and winning the Powerball. Mom is behind the wheel of our shitty Volvo, making a rare journey into the toxic summer smog of L.A. Although I am sometimes pissed that she won't give me a lift into Hollywood, I secretly admire that she finds it just as important to drive my little brother Micah to a playdate as to facilitate my budding career. My mom will never be one of the ranks of the 8x10 clutching, armchair directing, aggressively hustling stage mothers that haunt every waiting room in show business. Hers is a different kind of support. From her, I get ownership of my own life and a confidence to go my own way. On occasions like today, when it's really important, she will hold my hand. but mostly she guides me from the sidelines quietly. And the message to me is this: this is your game to win. In Hollywood, it works like this. You don't get an audition for anything unless you have an agent. He or she gets a call from a casting director who is working for producers who are casting a role written by a writer. In movies, the writer is weak and has little or nothing to say about anything having to do with the script they wrote. The producers have a big say, executive producers do not, and the director has the final word. However, in recent times, all of these players have been trumped by the desires of the foreign sales and marketing departments. These are the sole entities that choose the actors in 95% of all movies made today. In television, the writer is king, the director is weak, and the producers are grunts, and the executive producers hold the power. Some executive producers write as well, and that makes them showrunners, and they truly rule the TV roost. However, once they make a decision, they go to their bosses for approval, the vice presidents in charge of programming, although the actual title for this position changes year to year and network to network, who then vet everything for the head of the network, who is God. So, if you're looking to get a part in a movie or TV show, regardless of how big or small the part might be, it's wise to think of yourself in a live-action version of the arcade game Frogger. Any one of these layers of folks can blindside you, out of contention for any reason at all, and you must navigate your way over and beyond each gatekeeper you encounter. As I make my way through the process on A New Kind of Family, I, of course, have no concept of the agendas and personal fiefdoms I am conquering along the way. I just practice the same principles I use to this day. I know my lines, I give my character a point of view, and I keep it honest. Mom pulls the Volvo into the headquarters of ABC, then located in Century City and known to me as the location of Future Earth in Return of the Planet of the Apes. We're early, so we get a soda and wait in the giant three-story lobby. "How do you feel, Robbie?" "Good." "Do you want to practice?" My mom always said practice like I was a baton twirler. "No, I'm okay, thanks," I say, as out of the corner of my eye I see the casting director approaching. "Are you ready?" I nod. My mom gives me a hug and I follow the casting director through giant double doors. As I walk away from my mother, I am also walking away from my childhood. When I come out of these big doors, I will have a full-time job, and that job will have the pressures and scrutiny that some adults never face. It will fulfill my dreams and break my heart and lead me to experiences beyond imagining. I will never be the same. I'm 15 years old, and my life is just beginning. Chapter 7. The tiny agency that represents me has another young client who has just landed a big role. She lives in New York, is around my age, and is going to be in California for some meetings. My agent arranges for us to have lunch. My relationship with Corey is the extent of my dating, so I'm a little nervous even though I know this isn't a romantic meeting. Any time a young teenager spends with a member of the opposite sex is fraught with expectations. Will she like me? Will I like her? Is she cute? Will she think I'm cute? What if I make a fool of myself? The scouting report says she's an extremely smart musical theater actress who is taking Broadway by storm as the new Annie. Those are big heels to fill, so she's got to have some serious game. I'm nervous to meet her. I'm just one of four kids in a TV family, but she's fucking Annie. After more consideration than you would use to choose the location of a multinational war council, I decide to host young Annie at a local Malibu restaurant called Paradise Cove. Famous to me because I lost my virginity on the beach nearby, and possibly famous to Annie because it is the home for Jim Rockford's trailer in the legendary TV show The Rockford Files. I also bring my girlfriend because I'm an idiot. My mom drops Corey and me off at the restaurant, and I see my agent waiting outside. "Hi, Rob. Glad you could do this. She's excited to meet you." "Same here," I say. "Who's this?" my agent says with a smile. "This is my girlfriend, Corey." "Oh." I can't tell if my agent disapproves. It will take me years before I understand the inner workings of agents. "Well, come on in. She's waiting." Sitting in a corner booth is a curly-haired, brown-eyed, slender girl with a shy smile. "Hi, I'm Rob. This is Corey. I've heard a lot about you." "You too," she says. "I'm Sarah. Nice to meet you." Soon we're eating French fries and talking shop. I'm in awe of Broadway and can only imagine how difficult it must be to play a role like hers. Of course, I mention nothing of my own musical theater experience in Peanut Butter and Jelly, instinctively knowing that I am in no position to compete in a credit swap. "How old are you?" I ask.
15.
"Do you have a boyfriend or anything?"
"Not really," she says, glancing quickly at Corey, who has been bored to death by our conversation.
I begin to feel guilty. Corey's a normal kid. She can't relate to Sarah and me. Why would she?
She stays quiet as two young actors connect over a mutual passion. As we say goodbye, Sarah takes my arm.
"Will you do this forever, you think?"
"Do what forever?"
"Acting, silly."
"I don't know. I hope so. What about you?"
"It's what I love," she says, her eyes glowing with sweet intensity. "I hope I can do it forever."
She says this with a solemnity that is so honest that it moves me.
"Or at least until I'm an adult," she says, laughing.
We hug goodbye, and as my agent drives her away, I wonder if I will ever see her again. 21
years later, I'm at the Golden Globe ceremony, nominated for Best Performance by an Actor in a Television Drama for The West Wing. I don't win that night, but while I'm disappointed, I'm thrilled when Sarah Jessica Parker does win for her smash, Sex and the City. She said she wanted to do it forever, I remember, as she walks up to the podium.
There is not much to compare with the uproar that a successful child actor can cause on his family. Forget the esoteric, touchy-feely discussions of the pluses and minuses of fame. The simple logistical hurdles will kill you. What about school? Who's going to drive you back and forth? State law requires that a legal guardian be with you at all times. Which family member will be that, or do you hire someone to do it? If so, how do you find someone you can trust? My mom and Steve agonize over these decisions as Corey and I celebrate the fact that I won't be going back to Ohio, and I just might become a TV star. I cram as much time as I can hanging out at Little Doom Beach with my friends before I start shooting the show. Corey lathers on the Crisco oil in her tiny leopard print bikini. My buddies and I just laugh and boogie board. The surf crew, now calling themselves the Point Doom Bombers, are not impressed with my new job and still threaten to pummel me whenever they think I might try to actually learn how to surf. I may become famous, but I clearly ain't going to become a surfer. My mom's commitment to giving all her boys equal attention prevents her from spending 12 hours a day sitting on a set with me while I shoot. Chad and Micah have schoolwork and Little League and all the other activities of boys their ages. When mom isn't holed up for hours mysteriously writing God knows what in her office, she wants to be at home for her two younger sons. After meeting a number of candidates for the job as my guardian, including one of the Penn boys, I don't remember which one, Sean or Michael, but one of them, they wanted to be actors and thought this would be a good way to learn, we settle on a big, shaggy-haired Bostonian named Clark. He drives a ridiculous old cruise ship Cutlass, complete with big swatches of primer paint prominently displayed across its body. We will make quite an impression as we roll up to the soundstage. Clark is a huge sports fan and not adverse to buying my friends and me the odd six-pack of Coors. I'm not sure what my mom's criteria for a guardian were, but he certainly met mine. The next step in organizing my life as a working child actor was dealing with my education. I was always a fairly good student with better than average grades. I actually liked learning, which did nothing to help my social standing. So I hoped that I would be able to easily handle the transition from school to private on-set tutoring, which the law required to be a minimum of 3 hours a day. I was due to start high school in the fall. Santa Monica High School began with a sophomore year, and I would have to get their permission to stay enrolled while working. Many kid actors opt to drop out of traditional schools to avoid the difficulties of social reassimilation and the inevitable academic catch-up. I wanted to go to the same school as all my friends and be as normal as I could. After much wrangling, Sam Ojai begrudgingly let me stay enrolled and accepted the state-sanctioned tutor as a legitimate proxy. Rolling up to the soundstage for my first day, I feel the lightheaded electric pulse that I imagine is common to any kind of dream fulfillment. A little over 3 years ago, I was a kid in Dayton, Ohio, having my show business illusions shattered by an aide-de-camp of Telly Savalas, but still fantasizing about life as an actor. Now, I'm about to work my first day as one of the stars of a show on ABC. I meet all the other actors and they seem nice. The real star of the show, Eileen Brennan, is a dry and very funny actress, hot off her role in the hit movie Private Benjamin. I will play her son, Tony. My TV brother is David Hollander, a show business veteran who has already starred in countless commercials and episodes of TV shows, as well as movies, including the current hit Airplane. Lori Hendler, a savvy backtalker, is typecast as my savvy backtalking younger sister. In Harbinger of Things to Come, I will play the good-looking, vaguely uninteresting, and extremely underwritten straight man part. The other family that will share our house with us consists of a beautiful brunette who is known for being married in real life to the commander on the hit TV show Chips, and her daughter, played by a cute blonde who appears utterly uninterested in any form of acting whatsoever. I'm given an embossed red script binder with the title of the show in the lower right-hand corner. I receive it as if I'm being handed an original copy of the Magna Carta. We read through the script, try on wardrobe, and then are assigned dressing rooms, which is like being given the best clubhouse any 15-year-old could ask for, complete with a phone. I'm introduced to the wonders of a stiff cup of coffee and selection of 20 kinds of donuts every morning, a love affair that continues to this day. I learn the hierarchy of the set, who does what, and where my proper place is in the army of 200 people it takes to make an episode of television. For the first time in my life, I do not feel different. Even though I'm as green as a pine, I feel the satisfaction of fitting in, of belonging. The lessons are coming fast and furiously. During a rehearsal, I step on one of Eileen Brennan's lines, which means that I start talking before she's done with her line, and she gives me a withering look. I will never make that mistake again. I watch as she navigates the role of star. One day, she reads the latest script and goes ballistic, demanding that the producers and writers come to the set for a script meeting. We are sent to our makeshift classrooms as a very heated and tension-filled meeting goes on outside. It will be years before I properly appreciate the pressure she is under and how necessary it is for a star to fight every day, if they can, for the best writing possible. Eileen didn't win many of those battles on A New Kind of Family, as most actors don't, and I'm sure the show suffered for it. Most actors are very good judges of what works, and yet they are always at the mercy of writers or producers who can label them difficult or a diva. Meanwhile, if the show flops, it's always the star who takes the most blame. Which is not to say that there aren't moronic actors out there who would ruin Citizen Kane if given half the chance. But in general, I've learned an actor who's made it to a certain level knows what works for him or her better than anyone else. A New Kind of Family was filmed before a studio audience of about 200 people. They were tourists and folks off the street who were in turns excited and bored by the endless filming from 7:30 to midnight each Friday. When they could no longer be counted on to laugh at the jokes, a man would throw candy at them, which they would devour and then cackle like hyenas high on the sugar. A sitcom is basically a filmed play. You even have a curtain call, although unlike a play, it comes at the beginning before you film. Even though this was my first big job, I'd done enough theater to make me comfortable in front of the camera. We filmed 6 episodes leading up to our actual air date, and in early September 1979, our show debuted at 7:30 p.m. on Sunday nights on ABC. I was too unsophisticated to realize that we'd been put in the death slot, opposite the number one show in all of television, CBS's ratings juggernaut, 60 Minutes. They crushed us. I mean, it was a bloodletting. There were lots of tense, long faces the next week as we prepped our next episode. I was too young to understand the pressure. I was living my dream. It's Friday night. The studio audience is full. The Doobie Brothers, I Keep Forgettin', is blasting over the PA system. This is the week we will turn it around. This is the show we will kill it. It is also the first episode we've taped since our show's debut. I come out for my pre-show curtain call, and the crowd erupts. They go absolutely batshit crazy. Up until this point, I've been greeted with mid-level, warm applause, so I'm stunned. I look around, not sure that this ovation is for me. Maybe the actual star, Eileen Brennan, is standing behind me. But she's not. The cameras roll. I enter. Bedlam. For the first time in my life, I hear that particular, unique, high-pitched, piercing, hissing, sonic screech that is the sound of screaming teenage girls. We play the scene. Every time I open my mouth, the girls go ape. Just last Friday, I was happy if I got a big laugh. This Friday, after one show on the air, I can't get a laugh because my new fans won't shut up. it is a stark lesson in the power of television. Eileen Brennan, being a consummate comedian and a veteran actress, is having none of this. I can see in her eyes that she's livid. I hope she's not pissed at me. I'm just trying to get through the scenes. Finally, it's over, and no one knows quite what to make of what has just happened. For my part, I'm at once shell-shocked, embarrassed, and, in truth, loving every minute of it. As Clark and I arrive for work the next day, I head off to the makeshift classroom for my daily onset schooling. I'm studying my 10th grade French when a production assistant stops by with my very first fan letter. "Here you go, Rob. Got a bunch more up at the offices." I don't know what to say. It's all new. Someone has written a fan letter to me. Oh, and one more thing. From now on, no one under the age of 18 will be allowed into the studio audience, he says mildly as he heads out. I don't know whether to be upset or even whom to be upset with, but I do know that this new edict marks the end of my ear-splitting receptions. I turn my attention to the fan letter. I open it carefully, excited to read it. "Dear Mr. Rob Lowe, I enjoy you very much on the TV show The New Kind of Family. You are a great actor. Can you please send me an autographed photo of yourself? If possible, in a bathing suit or in your underwear. Sincerely, Michael LeBron, number 411214, Pelican Bay Prison." In our second week, our ratings are even worse. Although today, any network would absolutely kill to have our numbers. In 1979, if 14 million people watched you, you were on death's door. Today, a huge smash like 2.5 Men averages about that. Our executive producers are two smart and energetic women, both of whom are married to powerful husbands who run movie studios. This is their first big producing job, and they go on the offensive to boost our ratings, orchestrating a press barrage, personal appearances, and a trip to New York to compete against other actors on other ABC shows on the $10,000 pyramid. That's right, the $10,000 pyramid. Can you imagine that amount of prize money today? Hey, you've made it all the way to the final rounds, and you've won almost enough to buy a used car. The network doesn't want to be known as a home for idiot actors, so they gather their young stars for a game show audition to pick who goes to New York. I religiously watch Pyramid and am no slouch at charades, trivia, or similes, thanks, Mom, so I am chosen to go to New York. On the big day, I draw a cute 20-something actress from Eight Is Enough as my partner. We will play Tony Danza, a young ex-boxer who is a huge hit on the smash comedy Taxi, and a sultry brunette about my age from ABC's other big new comedy hope, Out of the Blue, starring some young comedian the network thinks could be the next Robin Williams. He won't be. I love Dick Clark, the host of Pyramid and already a TV legend and will continue to. But the man is absolutely mangling my introduction. "Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome Ron Loeb." I stop. He stops. I go back and enter again. "Ladies and gentlemen, Rob Lone." This goes on for a good 10 minutes until finally the game begins. The woman from Eight Is Enough reads me the clues.
Okay. It's something, the astronauts, Tang!
I shriek.
Ding!
Yes. I don't know what's gotten into me. I am in the kill zone and I can't miss.
Okay, they're old. They're really old and, the pyramids!
I yell, "Come on, girlfriend, we got 10 grand to win."
Ding!
We easily beat Danza and his little minx partner in straight rounds. At the final round in the winner's circle, I figure we have to cut our times down. I am treating this celebrity charity show like it's Wimbledon. "Let me give the clues." "You sure?" says Eight Is Enough. "Yes. Dick Clark's got my name right now. Rob, for $10,000, here is your first clue. Go!" It appears in the screen in front of me. "Founding father flew a kite."
"Benjamin Franklin." Ding!
"Cordoba."
"Ricardo Montalban." Ding!
And so it goes. We win with 10 seconds to spare. I donate my winnings to the Cleveland Amory Fund for Animals and the Wilderness Society. As we all squeeze together for the goodbye shot, Tony Danza's young partner surreptitiously puts her hand on my backside and keeps it there. "See you on the plane," she whispers. On the flight home, I have what is to be the first in a long series of lessons about the temptations of actresses. Although Corey is waiting for me back in Malibu, the excitement and glamour of the unfolding drama in the first-class cabin quickly overpowers my 15-year-old male willpower. What happens on the plane isn't anywhere near Erica Jong territory, but I'm definitely not going to be sharing my traveling stories with my girlfriend. Back in LA, the battle to save our show continues. I'm sent to Riverside, California for a personal appearance. Even at 15, I don't see how walking through the Riverside Fairgrounds will boost our ratings enough to put a dent in 60 Minutes. But I like snow cones as much as the next guy, especially when they're free, so off I go. There's a line of mostly young girls waiting to get an autograph. This time, I'm on the other end of the line and not sure what the protocol is. I make a rookie mistake. Dear Mary Sue, thanks for watching A New Kind of Family. I hope you like it. Good luck at UCLA in the fall. Go Bruins. All my love, Rob Lowe. I will learn that that is not the way it's done. Too much time, too many people to get through. In spite of wanting to connect personally, you got to keep it simple. Just write Mary Sue and sign your name. The network handler informs me afterwards. Later, on the way to the car, I see them. They are swarming, gathering in the shadows of the tilt-a-whirl, 20 to 30 girls who look to be between the ages of 12 and 16 years old. They are whispering, pointing, and staring at me. One starts to shake. Another lets out sort of a whimper and runs with her feet in place like she has to go to the bathroom. Another girl pushes the girl in front of her to the ground and runs toward me. The girl on the ground screams. Then they all scream, low at first, then building to a point where it sounds like a sonic knitting needle is puncturing your eardrum. And then they charge. I don't know it yet, but I will come to learn that being charged on the African savanna by a rhino is only fractionally more dangerous than being bull-rushed by a gang of 14-year-old girls whipped into a lather by hormones, groupthink, and an overdose of Tiger Beat magazine. "Hi there," is about all I manage before they are all over me. One girl grabs me by the arm, another by the hair. One girl is literally untying my shoes while another steals the laces. The network representative does nothing. "I bet this doesn't happen to Morley Safer," he says. I can only hope this kind of mauling will help our ratings, but something tells me it won't. On the long drive back from Riverside, I have a lot of time to ponder the conflicting emotions welling up inside me. On one hand, how cool is it to be mobbed by a bunch of girls my age? It's any guy's dream, right? And it's part and parcel of being a star, right? All true, more or less. But also true is that the whole experience feels a little shitty. And feeling shitty about something that's supposed to be exciting makes me feel worse. The girls' reactions seemed almost programmed, like they were both the performers and the audience in a teen angst drama that had nothing to do with me. It certainly wasn't about what a good actor I was. And if I was such a hottie to them, why didn't I have the same effect on those who knew me well back at school? And so the first wisps of an idea appeared on the horizons of my consciousness. And the idea was this: if you really knew me, you wouldn't like me nearly as much. Chapter 8. The network has shut down our show. It's not canceled. They say it's a creative hiatus. I've no idea what that means, but the practical ramification is that I get to make my first appearance at a real high school. I still don't have my learner's permit, so I take the bus 22 miles from Point Doom to Santa Monica High School. It's a huge monolith of a school with thousands of students of all races, backgrounds, and economic standing. There are also gangs, although not on the level of rival school Venice High a few miles down the road. I have a lot to navigate, particularly coming in a few weeks after everyone else, and it doesn't help that Corey and I are having trouble. She watched Pyramid and saw the cute actress putting her hand on me. She has retaliated against my tacit flirtation on national television by hanging out with a tough young surfer who will in later years become Malibu's resident paparazzo, causing Barbara Streisand to take out a restraining order against him. It is the beginning of the end for us. If I was expecting a reception from the girls at Samo High like the one I received at Riverside, I was mistaken. When I walk the quad, there is no indication that my TV career was noticed. The Mexicans don't care, the whites don't care, the blacks don't care, and the Malibu kids never cared. Part of me is disappointed and part of me is relieved. I am just like any other sophomore newbie. I dive into the subjects I love, history, marine biology, French, and grind it out on the ones I don't, anything math-related. I spend my time with my small clique and try to fit in with this huge new pool of faces. And I wait. I know our show's fate is hanging in the balance, but I try not to think of it. Soon, I get the call to come back to work. As Clark drives the harrowing road between the Pacific Coast Highway and the 405 freeway that has killed so many truckers, I notice that he seems out of it. When he passes a car by driving on the shoulder of the road, I know something's up. "You okay?" I ask.
Sorry. Long night.
We pull up to the soundstage. I can see all the producers and even some network executives milling around. We are late, so Clark pulls right up to them at the stage entrance. I open my door and wave hello. Clark opens his door and vomits on his shoes. It's all downhill from there. As I get my usual coffee and donuts, I notice a young black girl with pretty eyes grabbing the last glazed twist. "Hi, I'm Janet." "Hi, I'm Rob. Nice to meet you. Have you met Thelma yet?" "Who?" "Thelma, come on, I'll take you to say hi." I have no clue who this girl is or why she's on her set. But I do go to meet Thelma, who turns out to be a tall, dark beauty who could be Janet's mother. It's then that I notice that the two actors who play the members of the other family living with us on the show aren't anywhere to be seen. "Have you guys met Gwen or Connie?" I ask. They both look at me blankly as a production assistant ushers us to our seats around the table where we read through the scripts. Janet and Thelma sit in the seats usually occupied by the two missing actors. What's going on here? As we read the first scene, it all becomes clear. Janet and Thelma are replacing the missing actors. In the script, there is no explanation of what happened to the original family that was living with us or why these new folks have moved in. To this day, I have no idea what happened. I can only assume that someone at the network felt our ratings would improve with the more dramatic concept of a black and white family living together. Amazingly, they thought the viewers would simply accept this switch without even a goodbye to the previous family. Janet comes from a big family with tons of show business savvy. She's painfully shy, but we are about the same age, and we become confidants. On the day when our show is mercifully canceled, we console each other. "I'm done with acting," she says. Ever the optimist, I fill her head with a rosy vision of her acting future. "No, I tell you, I'm done. I'm going into music. If my brothers can do it, so can I." I wish her luck, hug her and the rest of the cast goodbye, pack up my dressing room, and leave. A New Kind of Family shot 13 episodes, 5 of which aired in 1979. 60 Minutes survives to this day. Next to me as I write this is today's newspaper. In it, I see a photo of my old friend Janet. The caption reads, "Janet Jackson sells out the opening night of her world tour." You think star athletes have a tough re-entry when they retire? Try going from endless free donuts, screaming girls, and a starring role on television to 10th grade driver's ed. It's almost as if my show never happened. It certainly didn't lead me to any new jobs, at least temporarily disproving the old adage about just getting your foot in the door. In fact, with money so tight at home, I have to go back to work on the weekends as a busboy at the Nantucket Light. You'd think I would have at least been able to land a gig as a waiter. On the positive side, it's easy to keep your head on straight when you're signing an autograph while clearing someone's lobster dinner. I go back to the life of any other teenager, except for the few times when someone yells out, "A New Kind of Family!" while I'm getting gas or walking down the street. But that's pretty rare. I guess our bad ratings didn't lie. Back at school, friends are trying out for the school's tennis and baseball teams. Charlie Sheen has an absolute bazooka for an arm and wants to be a pro ball player. We are constantly in his backyard batting cage or playing tennis ball baseball, the Malibu version of stickball. Every once in a while, his dad, Martin, will join us, cigarette dangling from his mouth, and completely crush a ball out of the park. He'll then laugh at us, then, maddeningly, run the bases backward. Charlie's brother, Emilio, still wants to be an actor and has taken their original family name, Estevez, to ensure he's not riding on his dad's coattails. Emilio is a few years older than me. He's got a car and is really making the rounds, auditioning for tons of roles. Charlie and I, and often my brother Chad, still make the occasional 8mm movie together, but now that I've been to the bigs, I see a little point in backyard movies. I'm a pro now. I'm moving forward, not backward. My mom's health has taken a turn for the worse. She's in bed most days, and even when she's up and about, she remains in her pajamas. I hate seeing her like this, in the grips of something she can neither understand nor explain. Both she and Steve feel the bad spells are from reactions to everything from smog, perfume, household cleaners, mold, food, air conditioning, paint, dust, water, and plastics. We finally replace our terrible Volvo, and our new car sits outside the garage, all windows open, for 6 weeks, outgassing, before my mom will enter the vehicle. She doesn't use her oxygen mask and gardening gloves to ward off the fumes like she used to, but instead has become sort of a recluse. There are never dinner parties at our house. She and Steve do not entertain friends. They don't go out to dinner or to the movies. My mom remains a whip-smart conversationalist, lover of books, loyal supporter of my brother and me, and, from time to time, she even surprises us with her former adventurous spirit. But mostly, she's just checked out, and I miss her. To this day, I have a terrible, visceral reaction to a woman in pajamas. When engaged, my mom is a fairly astute advisor, but she's got two younger kids to worry about, and she's battling her own issues. Dad is 2,000 miles away, so there's no career planning. There's no team low full of lawyers, agents, publicists, personal trainers, and the like that would today assemble around a 15-year-old kid with a little bit of success under his belt. There's just me. Eventually, however, I am poached from my little agency, where I was one of the few up-and-comers, despite my current status in the hospitality business, to a much larger, more sophisticated agency. That's the way it works in show business, and in life. If you have some success, you often outgrow those who are with you in the beginning. But you give them a shot to grow with you. If they can't or won't, you move on. My new representatives are able to get me my first movie auditions. Now I'm competing with kids who have much more experience, most of whom are over 18, and by law, able to work full-time on a set without any child labor restrictions. Like a boxer moving up in weight class, the prize will be bigger, but I'm not sure I can compete. The first movie audition is for a film about the music business set in the 1950s called The Idolmaker. I don't even make it past the first meeting. My boss at the Nantucket Light is not impressed with the odd tourist asking for my autograph and eventually fires me for my ongoing penchant for pilfering the occasional mud pie. I protest that I'm hardly the only dessert thief in the busboy ranks, but to no avail. My spirits are lifted, however, when ABC signs me to a holding deal, which means they will keep me in-house until they figure out what to do with me. It's not a ton of money, but it's enough to buy my first car, which I do on my 16th birthday, a white Mazda 626. It's a lifesaver on one hand. Now I don't have to take the bus for 2.5 hours every day to school, and a curse on the other, as mom has me driving my little brother Micah to and from kindergarten. It's hard to look cool in your new car with your 6-year-old brother in the back seat. I'm also delegated to grocery store duty, which I hate with a passion. I stagger around the Mayfair market for hours trying to find all the obscure items on my mother's list. But it still beats pulling the weeds out of our gravel front yard by hand. Each day at lunch, I check the bulletin board just off the quad to see if my agents have an audition for me. Finally, I do land my next job. It's a test show, or pilot, for a possible new TV series on ABC called Thrills and Chills. It's about a family of animal trainers, acrobats, and daredevils that form their own traveling circus. I play the young, crazy motorcycle jumper. Think a teen Evel Knievel, but in spandex. The first day on the set, the director, Ron Howard, who at that point was still playing Richie Cunningham on Happy Days, takes me aside. He's only directed once before, a low-budget B-movie called Grand Theft Auto, and he seems as nervous as I am. "Rob, I really need you to tear out on your bike after your last line. I mean, just as fast as you can, just crank it," he says. I'm cooking like a sausage in my skin-tight purple spandex, but this request has my blood running cold. Clearly, no one has told him that I can't ride a motorcycle. I only just learned how to drive a car, let alone really crank it.